Thank you, and good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Abel. I'm a deputy federal public defender, and I represent Mr. Glass in this appeal of the district court's denial of his motion to suppress. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Here, the district court found that Officer Gormley of the Oxnard Police Department had reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Glass for trespassing when he came upon Mr. Glass and his friend, Mr. Andrade, as they were walking out the door of an apartment complex. There is a body cam video here, which I think clearly depicts that Officer Gormley accused the men of criminal activity immediately before the men had any chance to do anything suspicious, expressly telling them that they don't, quote unquote, they don't belong here. Seconds later, he detained them and Mr. Andrade's mother arrives. She tells the officers she lives there and that Mr. Glass and Mr. Andrade were visiting her. Mr. Glass and Mr. Andrade say the same, reinforcing that they were there to visit Mr. Andrade's mother. But the officer is undeterred. He wants proof that the two men are on the lease, which, of course, is not necessary, as the men stated that they were there visiting a tenant and thus would not necessarily be on the lease. And the officer continues to question Mr. Glass and Mr. Andrade, but now he transitions his questioning from those questions potentially related to trespass to the defendant and his friend's parole and probation status. And that really becomes his sole focus. He runs a post-conviction status check. He's really looking for a reason to search these two men. There are two places that the court can reverse here. One is at the initial stop, which I do not believe was supported by reasonable suspicion, and then at the prolonged detention, which again must be supported by independent reasonable suspicion. Either of those points in time provide independent basis to reverse in this case. Again, I want to note that I think the video is crucial here because it starkly shows the injustice.
Let me ask you a question, counsel. What is my standard of review as it relates to this motion to suppress?
Your Honor, as to the factual determinations made by the district court, the standard would be clear error. However,
So if it is the factual determination is clear error, we have to take the facts that the district court finds and then apply the law as we need to apply the law after those facts are determined, right? Unless there's clear error?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the district court finds that your client was startled as a hesitating motion as an evidence of an intention to flee. Clear he was startled. Clear. The last person he wanted to meet with was the police officer. That's a fact the district court found, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the district court found that the policeman saw a tattoo, even though not apparent from the video, it was not there. But because the footage wouldn't have given the viewer the same perspective, that the police officer could have looked down and saw the tattoo. Correct? That's a fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then the last is there's a very high crime area. Didn't rely on his own expertise. The OPD tracked and analyzed the crime. The apartment and the area surrounding them were consistently among the top five problematic areas. The officers also had agent authority. Again, fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did not recognize the two inferred facts by the defendant's silence. All of that, you're saying, won't meet a standard of review for reasonable suspicion?
Your Honor, I think there's two responses that I would have to that. First, insofar as the video evidence is directly contrary, I think that we can look at that. And secondly, I think even accepting all of those facts, the tattoo as evidence of gang affiliation, the high crime area, and the nervousness or hesitation, those three things are really what the government and Officer Gormley relied on here, and I just don't think those three things are enough.
What is the standard of review for reasonable suspicion? I mean, you look at what the standard of review is for reasonable suspicion, and I guess I'm trying to figure out how it is I could, based on those facts, which I don't think are clearly erroneous, come to a different conclusion.
Your Honor, I believe once we take those facts, we look at it under a de novo review. So are those...
I know it's de novo, but you got the facts. And the whole purpose of this is for me now applying the reasonable suspicion law to these facts. And now you're saying, no, couldn't make it. Why?
I think the facts really boil down to just those three things.
There's one more. They didn't recognize the two.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that can have any legal weight here where the officer...
No, but it's a fact, nonetheless.
Absolutely. I think the fact that he didn't recognize them...
And the reasonable suspicion was for what? Trespassing. And didn't recognize the two. Had been given agent authority because of such a high crime area, and that doesn't add in? Come on.
Well, I think the agent authority really is just supplementing the high crime area. We can say high crime area in 15 different ways, but I don't think it adds anything to the analysis.
So is your argument basically that if you have a suspected gang member in a high crime area who appears startled when he's confronted by the police, that those three things, assuming that those are not clearly erroneous, don't add up to reasonable suspicion?
Yes, Your Honor. That is...
Is there some case that says that? I mean, I know there are cases about each one of those things individually, but is there some case that says that those things collectively don't add up?
In a perfect world, all cases would look the same, but the totality of circumstances means that every different case is slightly different. And that there are not, you know, that they don't line up in perfect order every time. But I think Your Honor identifies that at least as to two of the, or as to each one of those, they've never been held to be sufficient. So gang affiliation has not been held to be sufficient. High crime area has not been held to be sufficient. And expressly nervousness on multiple occasions by the Ninth Circuit has been held to be insufficient. So the question is whether
each one of the cases you cite about those, each specifically says this thing by itself.
Certainly, Your
Honor. We don't have it by itself here.
Agreed. And I do think it is a totality of the circumstances analysis. But when we look at the facts here, these are two men walking out of an apartment complex. There's not substantial additional evidence to add to that to change the circumstances. We're talking about 26 seconds in which the officers see them, which takes 15 seconds where no conversation occurs. And then it's really just the remaining 11 seconds where Officer Gormley purports to find reasonable suspicion.
Can I ask you a quick question about the so-called alleged prolongation of the stop? So it seems like there's evidence in the record that, so if there was reasonable suspicion to investigate him for trespassing, that would make it reasonable to find out their names and where they live. And it seems like there's evidence in the record that the other record check, the parole probation check, was all happening at the same time as that. So if that's the case, how can you say that the stop was unduly prolonged?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the records check was related to the trespass investigation. I think that's where it breaks down. These men did not suggest that they were here because they lived there.
But he didn't have ID, so I mean, it's certainly reasonable. You'd think if there was a basis for a trespass investigation to find out who he is and where he lives.
I think he stated he was homeless, so I don't know that where he lives is relevant. The question is whether he belongs there. And the answer to that was provided by his mother, by himself, and by Mr. Andre.
Okay, so your argument isn't that it was the parole probation part of the check that prolonged it, it's that they shouldn't have been able to do a name check at all. That whole exercise was unreasonable.
Given these facts, Your Honor, I'm not saying it's never reasonable, right. But given
Thanks.
These facts.
Okay.
I'm nearly out of time, so I'd like to reserve the remainder.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Julia Reese for the United States. Given the low threshold for preponderance of the evidence, given the low threshold for reasonable suspicion, which is considerably short of a preponderance of the evidence standard, and the deference that is due to resident law enforcement officers and judges and the inferences that they draw in making reasonable suspicion determinations, the District Court did not err in finding that there was reasonable suspicion for Officer Gormley to detain Mr. Glass. Now, what Officer Gormley saw that night was...
So can I put the same question to you that Ms. Abel answered for me? So if you know, suspect, if it's the three things that she said, just assume that as a hypothetical. Suspected gang member in a high crime area who, when he's seen by the police, shows startlement and some flustering and so on. Those thing, three things, is that enough for reasonable suspicion?
I think that those three things would be enough for reasonable suspicion, Your Honor. And I want to talk a little bit more and give some more context to the high crime finding that there was in this particular case. And I think it's important to look at the particular types of crime that were plaguing the Gateway Complex. Now, it was trespass, and the Officer Gormley explained that trespassing at the complex was linked to some specific crimes. It was linked to gang activity, it was linked to narcotics offenses, and it was linked to theft. And so what Officer Gormley saw, knowing with that background information, what he saw was two apparent gang members walking out of the complex after midnight with heavy duffel bags.
He didn't cite the duffel bags as something he relied on, though.
He did note the duffel bags. He explained the duffel bags as something that he observed when he came up. And I think when he was articulating what it was that he relied on, he didn't indicate that. But the reasonable suspicion analysis is an objective standard. And what you see is...
At one point, an elderly lady comes out and she says, "These are my boys. They're not trespassing." Would the officer still have reasonable suspicion after hearing that from the lady?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that the context, again, of that is important. At that point, Officer Gormley did not know who that woman was. At that point, Officer Gormley knew, however, that there were individuals in the complex that he called friendlies. Friendlies who would provide support and assistance to individuals when they were being confronted by law enforcement officers. And so what Officer Gormley is confronting is an individual who comes out. She's understandably upset. She kind of claims them and says that they're her children. And Officer Gormley then takes steps to that I would say would tend to verify or corroborate that. He asks what the men's identities are. He asks them where they live. He asks them for their address. And he even asks Mr. Andrade, what is the address of the complex and what is the unit number that your mother lives in? And as Officer Gormley said, he didn't know that the street address for the apartment at all, and he was unsure of the unit number. Now, given those circumstances, I don't think that reasonable suspicion was dispelled during the stop. And the steps that Officer Gormley took to continue to try to verify and corroborate what the woman who turned out actually to be Miss Andrade, Mr. Andrade's mother, to determine whether what she was saying was true. Now, the question here is, was it reasonable for the officers to stop them? Was it reasonable for the officers to run the records check, the identity check, and was it reasonable for the officers to run the criminal history check? And on the records checkpoint in particular, which I think, as the opening argument made clear, kind of is the crux of the defense argument, I want to point this court's attention to Hibble and Christian, both of which are cited in the government's answering briefs. And in both Hibble and Christian, the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit have recognized that checking a person's identity has significant investigative and safety value during a reasonable suspicion-based stop. Now, the investigative value is it can tell you whether someone's wanted, it can facilitate someone's location later, it can help clear a suspect. And here I think that the investigative value was enhanced because Mr. Glass had no ID. And that's quite similar to the facts that this court confronted in Christian, where the individual that they stopped wasn't able to provide any proof of his identification.
Now, counsel, it's my understanding then that you're really citing Christian for the authority to make the inquiries about the identity?
Yes.
Is that what you're doing?
Yes, and I think it also supports our argument that there is authority to make an inquiry regarding criminal background, and Hibble does as well, because both of those cases recognize that one of the values that an identity plays...
Well, if somebody doesn't have... I thought your argument was they didn't have an identity, so you could then make them check, background check, because they didn't have the identity on them. I thought that was your argument.
So I think that enhances the investigative value that the identification could play in the process. But I do think that even if they both had been able to provide proof of their identification, I think it's clear under Christian and Hibble that a court or that the officer still could run those identity checks, because identity checks have independent investigative and safety value. And I want to enhance or emphasize the safety value that an identity check can have. As Hibble recognized.
So you're saying then that the background check was just a normal thing that happens in every one of these kind of situations based on Christian?
I think that it would be reasonable to do this in most stops before you have reasonable suspicion dispelled. And I think that that's quite clear from Hibble. Hibble indicates that that checking somebody's identity is an accepted part of most Terry stops. That's what the proposition that Hibble stands for. And again, Hibble makes clear kind of why it would be reasonable to do that during most reasonable suspicion-based stops when you still have reasonable suspicion. And I do want to emphasize that limitation. If you dispel reasonable suspicion, the stop is over. You can't run the identity check at that point. You couldn't run a criminal history check at that point. But here, reasonable suspicion wasn't dispelled, and it was reasonable for the officers to continue to pursue the identity checks and the background checks that they ran. And again, the safety value of these background checks is important. What Hibble and Christian recognized is that a background check, an identity, can facilitate determination if somebody has a record of violence. Now, that is only relevant if you can actually run a criminal background check to check whether somebody has a violent criminal history. And so given those circumstances, given the precedent, I don't really think that it was unreasonable under these circumstances for Officer Bormley to run the checks that he did. And again, what these circumstances are is that you have two apparent gang members in a high crime area late at night coming out of a complex with heavy duffel bags. And before I sit down and ask if there are any further questions, I wouldn't be able to sleep if I didn't note one clarification that I noted last night. And I want to point out that on page 32 of Mr. Glass's opening brief and page 37 of our answering brief, both parties noted that Officer Gormley's body cam showed no pedestrians or other individuals going into or out of the complex during the encounter. That is true. There is nobody apparent on Officer Gormley's body cam. But last night, I actually reviewed the other officer's body cam that was involved in the encounter, which is actually not part of the record, but it was produced in discovery. And that does show a pedestrian, and it also shows a couple of individuals entering the complex at that time. However, Mr. Andre and Mr. Glass are the only individuals who exit the complex hauling a heavy bag. They have evidence, indications of gang membership. And as the district court noted, Mr. Glass had a very nervous and startled reaction to the officers, was very fidgety, and he had halting responses. Now, given that entire context, Officer Bormley had reasonable suspicion, and this court should defer to the inferences drawn by both Officer Bormley and the district court in that regard. Unless there are any further questions, the government will submit on the briefs.
Thank you. Abel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just, I think, in response to clarify the defense's position, I don't think there's any question that they had a right to ask Mr. Glass and Mr. Andre their names. The question is whether they had, which Christian stands for. They were looking for an identified person named Rick James, and only because it was reasonably related to that question, who is Rick James, were they able to conduct the background check. Same thing, Hibble says that that a statute requiring name disclosure is fine. The question is whether you can go beyond that and conduct a full-scale records check of individuals when you're looking to find out whether they are visitors to a property and the mother of one of the two is there saying that they were here visiting me. If I were questioning that, I would ask her, do you live here? With that, Your Honors, I would submit.
Thank you both for your helpful argument. The case has been submitted.